is in the facility where the conditions vary quite a lot. Like, some places in the facility had longer power outages than others. So I haven't gotten any confirmation about that.
Gary Blankenship, we want to thank you for being with us and for your reporting with the Marshall Project. We will link to your latest piece, Inside Frigid Texas Prisons, Broken Toilets, Disgusting Food, Few Blankets. And tune in tomorrow, Democracy Now!, as we remember the pioneering science fiction writer, Octavia Butler, who died 15 years ago this week. She gave one of her last interviews to Democracy Now! In 2005. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon House Representative Diego Hernandez resigns after allegations that he created a hostile work environment for women at the Capitol. Oregonians 70 years and above are now eligible to receive their COVID-19 vaccine, and the U.S. Supreme Court rejects Trump's bid to shield his tax records from the Manhattan District Attorney. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 22nd, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon House District 47 Representative Diego Hernandez resigned on Sunday after a nine-month investigation into allegations that he promoted a hostile work environment for women at the Capitol. Oregon House Democrats, along with Governor Kate Brown, had called for the representative's resignation earlier this month. After a week of hearings into Hernandez's actions, the House Committee on Conduct concluded that he had, on multiple occasions, created an intimidating and hostile work environment for women at the Capitol. According to an independent investigation, three women had come forward to accuse Hernandez of creating a hostile work environment that led them to believe their careers were at risk after they tried to break off romantic relationships with him. The House could have voted as soon as Tuesday, February 23rd, on whether to expel Hernandez had he not resigned. Hernandez said in a statement, quote, "Today I tendered my resignation so my colleagues may focus on serving Oregonians and so I can move forward with my life and focus on my health and family." The Oregon Health Authority reported 324 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 153,134. Oregon health officials reported no new deaths on Monday, meaning the death toll for the state remains at 2,155 people. Multnomah County had the highest number of cases on Monday with 83. There are currently 167 people hospitalized with COVID-19 in Oregon, including 47 patients in intensive care units. The OHA said that as of Monday, more than 820,000 first and second doses of COVID-19 vaccines have been administered across Oregon. Oregonians 70 years old and above are now eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine, along with previously eligible groups such as healthcare workers, long-term care residents, and K-12 school employees. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 28.1 million cases of COVID-19, while the death toll is approaching 500,000 people. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 66,000 new cases per day, a decrease of 44% from the average 2 weeks earlier. About 12% of people in the country have received at least one vaccine dose, with about 5% fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 111 million people in nearly every country. At least 2.4 million people have died across the world. Someone replaced a toppled statue at Mount Tabor with one honoring York, the only black member of the Lewis and Clark expedition. York was enslaved by William Clark, though on their westward expedition he performed all the same duties as a full member of the Corps of Discovery. He was a skilled hunter, he negotiated trade with Native American communities, and tended to the sick. When Lewis and Clark returned from the West Coast, he asked for his freedom, and Clark denied his request. It is not known what York looked like, but this bust depicts him as bald, with his eyes downcast. It is also not known who created the statue, but the Parks Department says it can stay, since Bureau policy allows for tributes to remain in parks so long as they aren't a danger to the public. The York statue replaces one that was toppled in October of last year amid protests for racial justice. Previously, the statue honored Harvey Scott, the editor of the Oregonian in the 1870s. Scott was known to be a vocal opponent to women's suffrage, so the statue was often the target of vandalism before being taken down. This statue of York is not the only one in Portland. There's another one at Lewis and Clark College. Portland City Commissioner Carmen Rubio heads the Parks Bureau. She said, quote, "We should regard this installation for both the important piece that it is, as well as a much-needed reminder to city leaders to hasten our work of rooting out white supremacy in our institutions, particularly our city government, where many processes exclude community participation and discourage engagement." A bill in the Oregon legislature would cut back on the criminal justice system's punitive approach from sentencing to parole. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A bill in the Oregon legislature proposes major reforms to the state's criminal justice system. House Bill 2002 is a sweeping measure that would scale back the system's reach, from limiting what offenses send a person to jail, to reforming mandatory minimum sentences, to reducing the number of people on parole. Shannon White is with the Partnership for Safety and Justice, one of the groups that requested the bill.
Those are the part of the bill that actually kind of shrink the system, limit its impact, because we know it's grown too big. It's become like the mental health default, the addiction default.
White says the bill came together in the wake of George Floyd's death. She says it saves money that would be reinvested in things like culturally specific services. Other groups involved in the effort include the Latino Network, Coalition of Communities of Color, and Red Lodge Transition Services. HB 2002 has a public hearing scheduled in the House Judiciary Committee on Thursday. Morgan Godvin is a commissioner on the Oregon Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission who spent time in Oregon jails and a federal prison for her opioid use disorder. She says her personal experience opened her eyes because she saw many women churned through the system, being released and rearrested again and again.
It was making them less safe. Jail was destabilizing their life. They were losing their housing. They were losing their job. And then being released back into the exact same circumstances from which they came.
Godvin helped craft the bill's parole piece. She says the current program negatively incentivizes people, relying on sending them back to jail. The bill would allow for telereporting to supervisors and limit the complexities of parole. White says reforming mandatory minimum sentences is important because it unties the hands of judges. She notes, nonetheless, that people who commit crimes need to be held accountable.
Part of what we're saying with these reforms is, let's go back to a system that allows judges to look at the individual circumstances of those crimes and make decisions that are based on what accountability makes sense for that person and for that victim.
The bill also would increase funding for community-based victim services. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
An independent probe into the death of 23-year-old Elijah McClain in Aurora, Colorado in 2019 accuses police and paramedics of wrongdoing. McClain, a black man, was stopped on August 24, 2019 by officers answering a call reporting a suspicious person in the area. The independent probe found that Colorado police and paramedics made a series of crucial errors that led to the young man's death. The probe says Aurora police had no justification to stop or use force to detain McClain, and responding paramedics sedated him with ketamine, administering a dose that would have been proper for someone about 50 pounds heavier than McClain. McClain lost consciousness and was taken off life support on August 30th. The report said, quote, "In looking at this single incident, the panel has insufficient information to determine what role, if any, bias played in the Aurora police officers and EMS personnel's encounter with McClain. Research indicates that factors such as an increased perception of threat, perception of extraordinary strength, perception of high pain tolerance, and misperceptions of age and size can be indicative of bias." The officers and medics involved in McClain's death were not criminally charged. However, his family filed a federal lawsuit last year against the city, several police officers, and other involved parties for violating the young man's civil rights. The U.S. Supreme Court has cleared the way for a New York prosecutor to obtain former President Donald Trump's tax returns. The Supreme Court ruled on Monday that Trump cannot shield his personal and corporate tax records from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. The ruling allows Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance to enforce a grand jury subpoena for the records. The documents will be subject to grand jury secrecy rules that restrict their public release. The focus of the issue is whether the Trump Corporation artificially inflated the value of Trump's properties to get the best possible loans. Investigators also want to know whether the company presented different values to tax authorities. The court's order is a decisive defeat for Trump, who has gone to extraordinary lengths to keep his tax returns and related documents a secret. There were no dissents noted in the Supreme Court's rejection. The Manhattan DA's office said they expect to take possession of 8 years' worth of the former president's tax information as soon as possible. Manhattan DA Vance issued a three-word statement in response to the court's order, saying, quote, "The work continues." Postal banking advocates say having accessible financial services at post offices could help the 12 million unbanked Americans recover from the pandemic-induced economic crisis. Lily Bolke has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Advocates for postal banking say having more financial services available at U.S. Postal Service locations could help the nation make a more equitable recovery from the COVID-19 economic crisis. More than 12 million people, or 6% of American adults, don't have a bank account. Another 16% aren't underbanked. They do have a bank account, but also use money orders, check cashing services, payday loans, or tax credit advances. Porter McConnell, with Take on Wall Street, says these alternative financial services often can be predatory or charge exorbitantly high rates. She says postal banking could fill a crucial gap.
It's infrastructure that's already there. It's a very skilled workforce. And the universal service mandate of the post office means that everybody gets to be served by the post office.
14% of black residents and 11% of Latino residents are unbanked, compared with just 4% of Caucasians. McConnell notes that big Wall Street banks have often closed branches in rural or low-income communities, leaving behind banking deserts. McConnell thinks the prospects for implementing postal banking in the U.S. are better than ever. It was included in the Democratic Party platform last year, as well as a draft of the CARES Act, and President Joe Biden has indicated support.
There's a lot of underbanked and unbanked communities, you know, in the middle of Boston, and there's a lot of, you know, unbanked and underbanked communities out in the Hill Country in Western Mass. And so what's great about it is that it serves both of those communities really well.
Senator Elizabeth Warren and Representative Ayanna Pressley are among the supporters of postal banking in Congress. Warren has said it could help the U.S. Postal Service find its own financial footing. The agency has lost $69 billion in the last decade, according to the Government Accountability Office. For Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Texas's energy infrastructure with Mitch Jones from Food and Water Watch, followed by a look at the City of Eugene's climate commitments clashing with gas utility Northwest Natural. At 6, it's Prison Pipeline, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow will again be rainy with a high of 47. Today in history, in 1819, the Florida Purchase Treaty was signed by Spanish diplomatic minister Luis de Onís y González Vara and U.S. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams. In the treaty, Spain agrees to cede the remainder of its old province of Florida to the U.S. The U.S. received the land at no cost other than the assumption of about $5 million of claims by U.S. citizens against Spain. The quote of the day is from South African cleric and human rights activist Desmond Tutu, who said, quote, "Do your little bit of good where you are. It's those little bits of good put together that overwhelm the world." President Joe Biden's pick for Attorney General, Merrick Garland, vows to fight white supremacy. An accused Capitol rioter claims she had VIP access, and Trump loyalists are willing to split with the GOP. With more on those stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times. The Senate Judiciary Committee begins confirmation hearings for Attorney General nominee Merrick Garland today. In 2016, Garland was nominated to the Supreme Court but denied a hearing by Republicans. When tapped by President Joe Biden, Garland said he was honored and eager to get to work.
Ensuring the rule of law and making the promise of equal justice under law real are the great principles upon which the Department of Justice was founded and for which it must always stand.
While some on the left have expressed concerns Garland is a moderate, he is expected to be confirmed. In his opening statement, Garland will vow to fight white supremacy and root out domestic political extremism. Global security researcher Noreen Chowdhury-Fink with the Sufan Center says it's a shift from policies post 9/11.
80% of the resources of the FBI were devoted to international terrorism and only 20% to domestic terrorism. And I think what was really extraordinary under the Trump administration was really the politicization of this.
Meanwhile, one of nine members of the Oath Keepers militia group, arrested for her role in the Capitol riot, says she wasn't there to participate, but to provide security for legislators and other key people. Attorneys for Jessica Watkins argue she had VIP access to the rally and met with Secret Service agents. The Justice Department says the group maintained a cache of weaponry near D.C., trained each other in military tactics, and pushed past the Capitol police barricades during the insurrection. Georgetown Law Associate Professor Vita Johnson is troubled most of the 235 people charged face only misdemeanors.
They're charged with trespass. They're charged with disorderly conduct. These are low-level misdemeanors. The U.S. Attorney's Office has the ability to charge those people with things like rioting, sedition, burglary. There are all sorts of statutes that exist on the books.
In his first public appearance since leaving office, former President Donald Trump will speak at next weekend's Conservative Political Action Conference about the future of the Republican Party, which new polling shows will likely include him. In a Suffolk University USA Today poll, half of respondents said the GOP should become more loyal to Trump, even if it means losing support from establishment Republicans. 47% said they would follow Trump if a new party was created. Trump has not indicated plans to run in 2024, but if he does, he won't have the support of Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, who has called on the GOP to find a different voice for the party's future. The U.S. House will continue its work on its $1.9 trillion stimulus bill today, with a floor vote expected by week's end. Taking questions on Twitter, President Biden said Americans will see stimulus checks soon.
We committed to you, Democrat and Republican, a $2,000 stimulus check. $600 came forward last time around. Another $1,400 will be coming.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer vowed to pass the bill before March 14th when expanded unemployment benefits expire. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Groups are calling for charges to be dropped against Indigenous people who toppled a statue in Los Angeles, and the Apache Stronghold files an appeal as the Oaks Flat land swap is scheduled to take place in March. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A prosecutor in Northern California is going after five Indigenous activists who toppled a statue of Junipero Serra last year in protest of the Catholic Mission System's founder. They all face felony charges, but community groups are calling for the charges to be dropped. Christina Onnestad reports.
They're called the Indigenous Peoples Day 5. The group of Indigenous women and two spirit activists are charged with vandalism for toppling a statue of Junipero Serra on Indigenous Peoples Day 2020, right out front of the Mission San Rafael in Marin County, California. Karina Gold is leader of the Confederated Villages of Lujan Ohlone, one of the tribes enslaved into the mission system Junipero Serra founded. She's calling for the charges to be dropped.
Our tribal people have been the objects of genocide here in California by the Catholic Church since the inception of California. The Junipero Serra, the statue that was taken down in October, is a symbol to California Native people and to many other Indigenous people about the genocide that happened on our lands when the Catholic Church first came here.
Despite the Catholic Church's history of genocide against Native Americans, some of its members have demanded Marin County's district attorney add a hate crimes charge against the activists. But more than 50 community groups and 75,000 petition signatories are demanding the charges be dropped, noting the nationwide reckoning with symbols of oppression. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting from San Rafael, California, for National Native News.
A nonprofit advocating for the protection of Oak Flat, a sacred site in Arizona, is appealing a federal judge's decision to not temporarily block the project that will turn the land into a copper mine. Emma Gibson from Arizona Public Media has more.
The nonprofit Apache Stronghold is one of a few groups that sued to stop a congressionally mandated land swap of U.S. Forest Service land, which includes Oak Flat, to Resolution Copper, a subsidiary of International Copper Companies. Attorney Luke Goodrich is representing Apache Stronghold in the appeal. He says the federal government plans to transfer the land on March 11th.
The government is actually destroying a centuries-old sacred site and making the religious practices there impossible. And so this case is actually really an easy case when it comes to finding a substantial burden on religious exercise.
They're challenging the judge's order that said the land swap wouldn't be a substantial burden on the Apache people's religious practice, among other things. Goodrich says he expects the court to rule before the March deadline. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
The National Congress of American Indians winter session kicks off this week, which is being held virtually. NCAI President Fawn Sharp delivers the State of Indian Nations address Monday. Tribal leaders throughout the week will interact with federal officials, White House representatives, and U.S. lawmakers. Tribal leaders are laying out priorities for the year and developing plans to work with the Biden administration and Congress. COVID-19 and the confirmation hearing for Deb Haaland for Interior Secretary are among top agenda items. The Lac-Qui-Taray Band of Ojibwe in Wisconsin is holding mass COVID-19 vaccination events planned for the next 7 Wednesdays. The tribe's clinic vaccinated more than 200 community members at its first event last week. The vaccines are open to eligible tribal members 18 years old and over. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Biden administration has pledged to create climate-friendly jobs for former oil and gas workers. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
an oil or gas well can keep releasing pollution long after it's retired from use.
When an oil and gas company walks away from a well that had been producing and does not plug it, those can impose heavy environmental and climate costs.
That's Jason Bordoff, director of the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. He co-authored a recent report on inactive unplugged wells.
They can leak methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas, into the air, as well as other harmful air pollutants.
According to the EPA, there are more than 2 million unplugged inactive wells in the United States. Bordoff says that together, they emit as much carbon pollution as 2 million passenger vehicles per year. President Biden has pledged to establish a program to plug many of these inactive wells. Bordoff says this approach could create employment for oil and gas workers who lost jobs during the coronavirus pandemic.
Many workers have lost their jobs and are struggling, and if they have a skill set that can be used to help the environment by plugging these wells, that can be a dual benefit. You're putting people back to work in a period of high unemployment until the economy is back on its feet, and you're providing an environmental benefit.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The U.S. has announced it will rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement, committing the country to dramatically decreasing its carbon emissions. That also could be good news for the world's food supply, which is being affected by rising carbon dioxide levels. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The United States has rejoined the Paris Climate Agreement, an indicator that the Biden administration plans to get serious about reducing the country's carbon emissions. Christy Ebi, a University of Washington professor of global health and the environment, says that's not only good for the environment, it also could help secure the world's food supply. A changing climate means more heat waves and floods. But Ebi says rising carbon dioxide levels will also make food less nourishing.
Experiments putting plants out under higher concentrations of carbon dioxide show that as we have even higher concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the nutritional density of major cereal crops decline.
Ebi says these studies were done on wheat and rice, the crops that provide the largest proportion of calories around the world. The warming climate also will affect crop yields. About 9% of the global population is food insecure. Ebi says with the U.S. rejoining the Paris Agreement, federal agencies like the Department of Agriculture can focus on climate change again.
We'll provide the support, human and financial resources that are needed for the U.S. to understand the magnitude and pattern of shifts and to identify approaches to protect our own citizens as well as citizens in other countries.
Historically, the U.S. is responsible for a quarter of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. The Trump administration announced the U.S. would leave the Paris Agreement in 2019, but the country's departure didn't become official until November 2020. Ebi says organizations are researching how to make crops more resilient to climate change, but more needs to be done.
There's lots of opportunity for innovation in this space to start thinking of how we can organize our agricultural sector a bit differently so it produces fewer greenhouse gases and the food that's produced is of higher quality.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 22nd, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, your stories, and your tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Leiswitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host Dime Roberts highlights art, literature, and media. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Aurora Josephson interviews painter Alex Lilly about his new works depicting the Portland protests of 2020. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be looking at Texas's energy infrastructure with Mitch Jones from Food and Water Watch.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined in the line now by Mitch Jones, who is Policy Director at Food and Water Watch, which recently put out the article, "The Texas Deep Freeze is a Fracking Failure." And I wonder if you could just start by maybe talking about that. What role has fracking, among other things, played in the current crisis that Texas has been facing the last couple of weeks?
Sure. First, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. The line that was put out by the Republican leadership in Texas that windmills were to blame for the power outage was a cover for the fact that the majority of the electrical power that went offline was actually at gas plants that were being powered by fracked gas. So that's one way in which fracking is to blame. You know, natural gas has become a dominant form of electricity production, not only in Texas, but across the country due to fracking. But also, ironically, fracking contributes to the climate change, which is causing these ever-increasing deep freeze events as far south as Texas, which actually then fuels that immediate crisis. So in a way, fracking is responsible for the immediate crisis because of its effects on climate change, but it's also responsible in many respects for the electric power failure because of the fact that the state is dependent upon fracked gas electricity, which failed miserably in the storm.
And as I understand it, that's not just affecting Texas. It's also there are energy pipelines from Texas into northern Mexico that's also faced more than 4 million people without power in northern Mexico because of the Texas failure.
Yeah, the two are related. Obviously, Mexico also was having the same, you know, that immediate northern region of Mexico was also experiencing the same weather patterns as Texas, and I imagine some of the same technical issues also took place in Mexico, but there definitely is a connection between the problems in Texas and the problems in Mexico, and the fact that in these extreme temperatures, if the pipelines and the compressor stations and the electrical facilities have not been properly winterized, they're going to fail. And because Texas has decided that it wants to have its own electric grid not regulated by the federal government, and because it has deregulated its statewide electricity market, those plants, those pipelines, that infrastructure has not been winterized because it's cheaper for the companies and they make a larger profit.
And let's talk a little bit about the deregulation of the energy infrastructure in Texas. I was surprised in your article to see the name Enron, which I haven't seen in a couple of decades. Maybe people aren't familiar with that company and what role they played in really devastating the energy infrastructure in the country, and particularly in places like Texas, and what kind of philosophy they proposed and how that's played out in Texas as well. Maybe you could describe that.
Yeah, well, you know, Enron, famously the smartest guys in the room, as the book about the disasters with Enron was titled, is an energy trading company. And they have pushed, or they did push, the decades in the 80s and 90s and the early 2000s for deregulated energy markets where traders were going to be able to make huge profits off of the buying and selling of energy, which they have. You know, the company that's owned by Jerry Jones, who's also the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, declared that they had hit the jackpot last week when pipelines were freezing and the gas that they produce was scarce and therefore much more expensive than it would be otherwise. This is the market that Enron had worked so hard to create, where you have a, for all intents and purposes, unregulated energy market in which those of us who are, you know, trying to heat our homes and cook food and keep the lights on are at the whims of energy traders who are clearing huge profits at the end of the day while the rest of us sit in the darkness.
So one of the impacts of this deregulation has been that a number of Texas customers who found themselves without power are now receiving huge electric bills. Could you explain a little about how that's impacting people?
Well, obviously, if you receive a $16,000 electric bill for a couple of days of electricity, the average person isn't going to be able to afford that. I mean, if you think about what your typical monthly bill is, you know, I live in a three-bedroom row house in Baltimore. We have hot summers and cold winters, and, you know, at its most expensive, I'm paying maybe a couple hundred dollars a month. I couldn't imagine getting a $10,000, $15,000, $16,000 bill for a couple of days. But this, too, is the result of that market system we were just talking about, where the way that most areas, most states, most regions have systems to get utilities to guarantee they will have electric capacity, generation capacity, years in advance. Texas doesn't have that system. Instead, what they did was they said, when the system has a huge spike in demand, either because it's really, really hot or really, really cold, you are going to be able to increase your prices for electricity by a lot. In Texas, it's capped at $9,000 a megawatt hour, which is a lot of money. That's supposed to be the incentive for the electric companies, the utilities, to build more capacity. But perversely, what it really does is says, you know, if we can constrain the amount of electricity, the amount of energy we have to deliver, we can sell it at ever higher prices. And so, weirdly, in Texas, the system that is supposed to be incentivizing having enough electricity available for everyone really incentivizes the companies to control scarcity so that they can charge ever higher prices and really devastate households who cannot afford to pay those ridiculous amounts that their bills are coming in at.
Wow. And how are they allowed to do that?
They're allowed to do that because Texas has control of its own grid and because it deregulated its electricity market about 20 years ago, where it relies on competition between various electric retail electric providers. And so they're in competition with each other. If you're lucky enough to have signed a contract with a firm where the electricity is going to be provided at a fixed cost, then those price spikes aren't going to hit you. But a lot of these companies, that's not the case. Your price is going to fluctuate with what they're paying for electricity. And so if they're paying $9,000 a megawatt hour, those costs are going to be passed on to you.
Wow. Do you think that this is one argument for a public utility district?
It's definitely an argument for the takeover of electric utilities, making them public, making them controlled democratically on behalf of the people and not on behalf of profit. The same goes for electric generation. You know, we really need to realize that electric utilities, electric generation, and the production of energy are too important and too vital to our day-to-day lives to be left to for-profit corporations that are just looking for ways, like Enron did, like those companies did last week in Texas, to game the system and gouge their customers for as much money as they can. We can fix that if we have publicly controlled utilities that are run for the benefit of the people.
And how is this also an argument for a Green New Deal, despite what some right-wing politicians are saying, that this is a challenge to the Green New Deal?
Well, again, you know, the failures in Texas were by and large in the fossil fuel plants. Yes, some wind turbines did freeze, and the reason for that is largely for the same reason that a lot of those plant, natural gas plants failed, and that is that the turbines weren't winterized. You know, you have turbines in much more extreme conditions all around the world, and because they are properly winterized, they're not failing in cold weather. But a real Green New Deal that has at its focus a managed decline of the fossil fuel industry and a managed build out of renewable energy like wind and solar, while also focusing on taking care of frontline communities and workers in the fossil fuel industry, will have the advantage of planning for these increasingly extreme weather events, whether it's cold snaps in Texas or wildfires in California. You know, we need to be able to prepare for both, and we need to be able to do it in a way that's going to keep the lights on, keep our refrigerators running, keeping our stoves going, and keeping the heat or air conditioning on. And the way to do that is to plan for it, to work on it, and not leave it to the whims of for-profit corporations.
I wonder if you can talk about the Electric Reliability Council of Texas and how their role in operating the grid in Texas has led to what people are facing.
Well, the big issue, I think, with ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council, is that it's not, it manages an isolated grid in Texas. You know, of the 48 lower states, Texas is the only one whose grid, by and large, is not connected to any other states. There are parts of Texas for which that isn't true, but for the most part, that is true, and that's where the real failures come. But ERCOT itself is managed by the Public Utility Commission, which is appointed by the governor. So the failures here are really begin with the elected officials of Texas, with the governors who appoint the public utility commissioners, with the legislators who deregulated, this was back when George W. Bush was the governor of Texas, deregulated the electricity market there, that refused to impose regulations on the electricity market to make sure that it is actually reliable and built and working for the people. And so while ERCOT manages that system and certainly made mistakes in the past week, they ignored the utilities that told them they weren't going to be able to handle the weather event that everybody knew was coming. They are culpable. But they're overseen by appointed officials who are appointed by elected officials, and the rot in this system begins at the head and goes all the way down. And it's really, in many respects, the culmination of the fight against competent government in America that really kicked off 50 years ago and, you know, reached in some respects a height in the Reagan administration and then again in the Bush administration and most recently in the Trump administration. And what we really need is elected officials who are doing the will and the work of the people to bring these utilities under control and make sure that they're being run on behalf of the people.
And the public utility district idea isn't one that is untested. In Washington State, for example, a state that also prides itself on independence, particularly in the rural areas, there are 28 public utility districts across the state. How does a public utility district work, and can it be something that can be implemented across the country?
Public utilities are not rarities. They are not unusual. Los Angeles has a public utility. Cleveland has a public utility. It's what Dennis Kucinich was famous for when he was the mayor of Cleveland, was keeping that utility public. You know, between rural electric co-ops, which aren't necessarily government-run but are owned and managed by the people themselves who get served, or whether it's an outright government-run utility, these utilities are responsible to the local people who they are providing the service to. Now, of course, that doesn't always in itself determine that you're going to get good service, because you need to actually have the right people in charge. But what it does do is it makes them democratically accountable to the people, so that when they're not performing well, the people have a voice in making sure that the people, that the folks who are in charge of them, are replaced with other folks who will actually do the job right. You can't do that with investor-owned utilities, with investor-owned oil and gas companies. We don't have any say in who runs those companies or for what purpose they make actions. And so the whole idea of having public utilities is that they are more responsive to the people who they serve, right? And it is a service. They're not, you're not the customer, right? They're serving you. And so that's the concept that we need to spread across the country, that these utilities, and also the fossil fuel industry itself, are things that need to be controlled by the people. They need to be controlled democratically, and they need to be controlled in a way that's going to transition us off of fossil fuels and onto renewables.
Well, and on that note, we're going to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, I've been joined by Mitch Jones, Food and Water Watch. Thank you, Mitch, for being a part of KBOO today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, and I hope you all have a great day in Portland.
I'm Jenka Soderberg, reporting for KBOO Radio.
Climate groups in Eugene are claiming victory as the city council is expected to deny a contract extension to the gas corporation Northwest Natural. Northwest Natural has refused to commit to reducing carbon emissions, and the city council will allow their contract to expire in May instead of renewing a 10-year contract with the natural gas utility. Months of public pressure and many hours of public testimony about climate concerns and the health impacts of fracked gas pushed the city to demand more carbon reductions from the corporation. Eugene City Council will announce its final contract decision this evening at 7:30 p.m. To understand more about the community concerns and the negotiations, we go to this piece from KBOO's Nat Moon that first aired on February 11th.
In 2014, Eugene made some news by being a city with some of the most ambitious climate goals in the country. Yet in 2020 and 2019, when these negotiations first started happening, they had done relatively little to actually implement those goals. And so what we started asking for was that the city work to renegotiate the franchise agreement to create kind of enforceable regulation on Northwest Natural in line with the goals that are overwhelmingly supported by the residents in Eugene. And so what we're doing here in Eugene is experimenting with this franchise agreement and seeing how far can we push franchise agreement negotiations to use them to implement our climate action plan at the city level, and to really give those ambitious climate goals we set in the early 2010s some teeth to make a measured transition away from fracked gas and towards renewable energy, which we know is, you know, not only better for the climate, but also safer for people's health.
My name is Dylan Plummer, and I'm the grassroots organizer with Cascadia Wildlands. Cascadia Wildlands is a bioregional environmental and climate justice nonprofit dedicated to defending public lands, protecting imperiled species, and resisting fossil fuel infrastructure throughout the Cascadia bioregion of Oregon and Washington.
So tell us a little about the agreement that's set to lapse with Northwest Natural in Eugene.
So in 2019, the franchise agreement that the city had with Northwest Natural, our local fracked gas utility, expired. And so instead of the city just signing back on to another 20-year agreement, which essentially just gives the frack gas utility access to our public right-of-way and kind of lets them, gives them a free pass to do whatever they want, whether it's building new pipelines or expanding or repairing existing infrastructure, our community asked our city council to instead renegotiate that agreement to include our climate recovery ordinance goals. I think there was a wave in the early 2010s of cities saying, you know, we're going to put these non-binding climate goals in place. And then, you know, 10 years down the line, we're looking back and seeing that, you know, not only did we not reduce emissions, but oftentimes our cities actually increased emissions. And one of the big players in that has been increasing our national reliance on fracked gas for heating and for other building appliances. There's also been, in recent years, a wave of cities really taking on the fracked gas industry. So there's been over 40 cities in California, in Washington, and some on the East Coast actively taking measures, passing binding ordinances to stop the construction of new fracked gas hookups in buildings, and to actively regulate and transition away from this climate polluting fuel.
My name is Tim Morris. I am the board president of the Springfield Eugene Tenet Association. I'll go back between our title and our acronym, which is CETA. So CETA is a 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to renters' rights and service. And as an organization, we have a free hotline where tenants can call in, ask questions, you know, get answers and, you know, share their concerns. We're able to provide information and resources if possible. And one of the things that we are able to do that no other organization or, you know, what we really see is we're able to really listen into the conversations of the phone calls that we get from people that are really in crisis or in need and hear what the issues really are. So we're directly connected with tenants that are struggling. And so our demographic is primarily low income. Over 70% of our callers are low income. We serve a lot of families with children, people that have people that identify with disabilities, the elderly community, communities of color, and really are dedicated to supporting these, but also recognizing that sometimes that service goes beyond, you know, being able to answer a hotline call and do that. It's advocating for folks as well and trying to bring some systemic changes. And so that's why CETA has joined this coalition, and we're excited to continue the conversation about how climate change is really affecting tenants.
And Tim, through your work, are you seeing the effects of this fracked gas that tenants are using in their own homes?
When it comes to the difference in a home between electric and gas, it actually is cheaper to have electric in your unit. And we know that a lot of homeowners are struggling to make that transition to change from gas into electric. It is a little bit more expensive upfront to get new appliances and super get that. But for renters, that choice is not there. They don't have a choice of what kind of unit they're living in. They don't have a choice of how their health is going to be impacted by gas. And primarily what we're seeing is that for gas units, it's more expensive to live there. However, more lower income people are living in units that have gas rather than having electric. So more lower income tenants in our community are being negatively affected with their health, their financial situations, and so many, you know, in so many other aspects because of the natural gas that's already in our infrastructure. Gas has a huge impact towards people's health. That absolutely also primarily affects communities of color and lower income renters. And we can see that particularly in the Bethel neighborhood where the air quality is so bad that some tenants and residents that live there talk about how they don't send their children outside to play because they know how bad it's gonna get, how asthma rates are much higher just in that small community compared to the rest of Eugene. It's been kind of a struggle really highlighting the climate change issues that happen because of natural gas or because of poor air quality or pollution. But also it's been really, really difficult to highlight how many lower income renters and how many communities of color are being impacted because they don't have a choice in whether or not that they can move into an apartment that has gas or move into an apartment that has electric.
Monday's city council meeting was a turning point in the campaign. Here's Councillor Claire Syrett with her statement regarding Northwest Natural.
We would do better with an agreement than without one. I agree. I think that is true. But the issue is that when you have an agreement between two parties, both parties have to be in agreement. And right now, Northwest Natural is not showing a willingness to meet us in this agreement on the terms that we as a council would all, a majority would vote for. And we aren't seeking an adversarial relationship, and choosing not to renew the franchise agreement isn't going to put us in one unless that is the choice of Northwest Natural. So I wish I could be as hopeful as Councillor Zelenka is that they will move towards our position and will work with us as a true partner. I am seeing a lot of evidence that it is not their true disposition to do that, and not much evidence that they are truly seeking to work with us to reduce greenhouse gases.
That was Councillor Claire Syrett of the Eugene City Council. And here's Councillor Jennifer Gay's statement.
Initially, because I felt like having Northwest Natural as a partner in this effort would be ideal, it seems that dragging out these unsuccessful negotiations is not going to benefit anyone. And it's time to look for different ways for us to achieve our climate recovery goals concerning the use of natural gas. At all points in the extraction, processing, transportation, and use of natural gas, toxic pollutants are released into our environment. This harms our land, our climate, and ourselves. We cannot continue using fossil fuels like we have in the past. If Northwest Natural does not want to be a partner in reducing these negative impacts, then we need to find other ways to protect our community as a community.
That was Councillor Jennifer Yeh of Eugene. Dylan, I'll let you tell us a little bit about the meeting, and if you could, talk about the significance of letting the agreement with Northwest Natural lapse.
So these negotiations have been behind closed doors up until now, but we're really optimistic that our city council is going to tell Northwest Natural and tell the city that they're going to walk away from the franchise agreement negotiations as they currently stand, because Northwest Natural is not cooperating and is actively being a bad actor in these negotiations when it comes to implementing the climate recovery ordinance goals that our city passed and that are widely supported by our residents. We're expecting the city to take bold action to really implement those ambitious goals that we set years ago and to put our city back on track to be a leader in climate action.
Northwest Natural also gave testimony at Monday's council meeting. Here's Catherine Williams, Vice President of Public Affairs and Sustainability.
Northwest Natural has been a willing partner for the past several years to help reduce emissions in Eugene. And we don't believe the direction discussed tonight is in the best interest of our customers, community, or the climate. A mandate on electric equipment that takes away choice may be a well-intentioned gesture, but it's an ineffective and expensive way to combat climate change. All forms of renewable energy are needed in a balanced low-carbon future. That's why Northwest Natural is moving forward with our plan for a carbon neutral pipeline by 2050. We will continue to work at the state level to lower our emissions, so no matter the outcome, we know we are on the right path.
The biggest barrier here to the transition is the obfuscation of science by the gas industry and their kind of continued work in the political sphere to undermine climate action and what we know is also action for increased public health and safety, whether that's through their PR campaigns, whether that's through litigation or lobbying. And another thing that's incredibly disturbing that the frack gas industry has been undertaking is actually financially incentivizing for residents to switch from electricity to gas. And electricity here in Oregon is actually generally pretty climate neutral or carbon neutral, in that the majority of it's coming from hydropower. So when the frack gas industry is financially incentivizing people to switch from their electric appliances to gas, they're dramatically increasing the emissions of households and providing an active barrier towards any kind of transition away from fossil fuels. So not only is frack gas not a bridge fuel, but the frack gas industry is literally working to take us steps back in our efforts to moving towards renewable energy.
Grassroots organizers like yourself have spent countless hours researching and talking to folks, doing publicity. But being in Eugene, your efforts have encouraged the local government there to actually consider putting their money where their mouth is, so to speak. Do you have any advice for other communities around the country?
I mean, just advice, if you're passionate about something and you see that there's something wrong, it's absolutely so important to come speak up, present, come bring your perspective. And that when, if you're right and you are, if you're on the right side of history, and you're able to convince, you know, one, two, three people to come, those people can then also convince more, and then you can grow a coalition, just like what happened with this fossil-free Eugene coalition that's begun.
You've been listening to interviews with Dylan Plummer of Cascadia Wildlands and Tim Morris of the Springfield Eugene Tenants Association. Additional audio is from councilors Claire Syrette and Jennifer Yeh of the Eugene City Council, as well as Catherine Williams of Northwest Natural. Learn more about the Grassroots Climate Campaign and the Fossil Free Eugene Coalition at 350eugene.org. You can also find more information about this program at kboo.fm. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Nat Moon.